All right. Hello, everybody. Literally right as soon as I went live, Conrail's right there. Anyways, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, however, wherever you're listening. It is afternoon right now. So hopefully everybody's doing well. It feels like forever since I did my last show, even though I literally just did one, I think, last Thursday as well. Anyways, hopefully everybody's doing well. It is a wonderful afternoon here in Pennsylvania, and today we're going to be talking about the ongoing disaster that is U.S. foreign policy. And I have a phenomenal guest with me today, but before we get into that, please make sure you go to all the links below where you forgot everything that we got going on. My guest, everything he's got going on. I know he just launched a new show recently and he's been crushing it. He's had some really awesome guests on. I've been listening to it quite a bit, and he's had some people that I'd definitely like to get on as well. But I'm sure he'll be able to tell us all about that here in a little bit. Of course, go to all the links below, specifically Tiger Fitness through the link below. Use code Kyle at checkout to let him know that I sent you. Fox & Sons Coffee as well. So, yeah, like I said, today we're going to talk about the ongoing disaster that is U.S. foreign policy. Lots of stuff going on, and sometimes it also seems like there's nothing going on. So, we're going to talk about all of it today. So without further ado, let me run the introduction and we will get right into it.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This Labor Day at Lowe's, shop member-only doorbuster deals for a limited time. Save $50 on an Ego string trimmer, now $169. Plus, get 50% off select Holland pavers. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, Labor Day doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9-1, while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
All right, everybody, and welcome back to the show, my dear friend, Kyle Anzalone. How you doing, man?
Doing well, Kyle. Thanks for having me back on. I always enjoy getting to come on your show.
Yeah, well, I'm always grateful to have you here. So real quick, why don't you let everybody know where they could find you and where they could support you? As I mentioned, you started a new show that's just been absolutely killing it lately. So why don't you tell everybody where that's at?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And so I'll start with the most important thing first, because it's a lot. Follow me on at Kyle Anzalone _. I live stream my shows on Ets, both of them. I post all my articles on Ets at the end of every day. Everything I write goes up there. And so if you want like kind of a catch-all, follow me on Ets and then, you know, hit like the notification thing so you definitely see my tweets. And then I do a bunch of work. As you mentioned, I have a new show that's the Kyle Anzalone Show. It's like quite a bit higher production than all the stuff I was doing in the past. I got a producer. I'm having like really great guests on. Recently had Daryl Cooper, Kelly Vallejos, Daniel McAdams. Like, you know, like just really good people with really great insights on foreign policy. And then my other show is Conflicts of Interest. I try to do that still 3 days a week. And in the rest of my time, I'm mostly a writer at the Libertarian Institute. I do the news there. I'm also writing some news now for judgenapp.com. And then I am the opinion editor at antiwar.com.
Yeah. Well, you are a very, very busy man. Like I said, I've been really enjoying your show lately. The episode with Daryl was great. I listened to the one with Benjamin Ablo today as well. I feel like I got a few of the other ones recently. I really enjoyed the one with Michael Tracy as well, because he's always good for a little bit of snark as well.
Love it, yeah.
Yeah. He's probably one of my favorite followers on Twitter. As well as like the Carolina Lion, I think his name is, which our mutual friend Jose Nino kind of pointed out to me. And he's been really, really great for a lot of the insights as well.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that account, but I will check it out, because I've had Jose on my show, and I'm a big fan of his work. We run him all the time at the Institute and antiwar.com.
Yeah. So, kind of going into some of the stuff I wanted to talk about today. I guess we should just mention it in passing, but the whole Jeffrey Epstein stuff, it's kind of low level slop, if you will. Although I'm not saying it doesn't matter, but it does seem kind of like just this gets everybody going, and no matter what happens, no matter what the facts are, everybody just comes to their own conclusions. And just, I don't know, what was your opinion on some of that stuff that happened within the last week?
Yeah, so I guess a couple of things. The first is that I really just try to dedicate my time as much as I can to foreign policy. And that means I know, I ignore, and I don't understand things that are hugely important to all of us, and I rely on other people. And that includes the Jeffrey Epstein thing, like COVID. Like, I didn't pay as much attention to that as I probably should have. But at the same time, I feel like somebody's got to cover the wars, and that's kind of my gig. And so that's where I focus my attention. So as far as, you know, what should have come out of this, what people were hoping for the Department of Justice to actually release, I don't know. What I do know is it seems like this is actually something that's hurting Trump politically, more so than even bombing Iran, you know, or not ending the war in Ukraine. I see a lot of people who I would consider not super politically active. You know, they like have politics, they're Democrats or Republicans.
Right.
But not only are they talking about the Epstein thing, but they're linking Epstein to Mossad. And so, you know, kind of like the Glenn Greenwald sets thing, where I feel like a part of the white pill is in the reaction, where, you know, this was supposed to be something that was going to ruin Glenn. It was supposed to humiliate him and embarrass him. And everybody was just like, ha ha, nice try, Mossad. We all know that Glenn's gay and we don't care. Like, you know, this isn't a big deal to us. What's a big deal is that an intelligence agency from a foreign government is trying to ruin one of the most prolific and important American journalists today. And look, I have no idea if Mossad or another intelligence agency was behind it, but that's a more and increasingly common reaction, particularly on the American right, I think it is something that we should be hugely happy about. And, you know, is a step in the right direction. Now, you know, of course, I should say this comes with some anti-Semitism, and I'm not for that. So this isn't about, like, you know, the Jews are behind everything. But if you look at how much U.S. foreign policy, if you look at what's going on in the White House, where the CIA director, as Matt Blumenthal has reported, you know, this isn't hysteria, this isn't anti-Jewish propaganda, this is a report from an American Jewish journalist explaining that our CIA director is just amplifying Mossad talking points within the White House at this point. And so for people to understand, even if it's not like necessarily all pointed, even if people aren't reading the gray zone, the fact that they generally understand that there was this massive conspiracy involving influence and sex trafficking, and that Israel had something to do with it, that I think is a really good thing.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more, actually. And it's very interesting because, like you said, it's kind of like the gray zone, and a lot of the people that we would consider kind of like our colleagues and people that generally agree with us on a lot of things, foreign policy, their narratives that they've been putting out for years are now starting to get more and more mainstreamed. And it's not necessarily because of any effort of their own. It's more of the lack of transparency of the individuals that these people voted for that's kind of causing this reaction. And another thing I want to get your opinion on is our dear friend Scott Horton kind of getting his I don't want to say licks, but like I keep saying that like 2025 now is the year of Scott Horton, because, you know, the Tucker interview, he's starting to get blended in more with the American right, which I think is awesome. He just had Orrin McIntyre on his show. He's doing all these big debates. It really seems like, you know, our dear friend and, you know, your boss for all intents and purposes, I guess, is now getting what I feel is the recognition that he deserves. And I feel like some of that's coming your way as well. So just kind of your thoughts, you know, more optimism about what's going on with Scott.
Yeah, well, I mean, not only that, I guess I hope and I think it's kind of like, you know, a little example of the direction that the country and politically the right is moving in. You know, of course, the right did just vote for Donald Trump, the MAGA agenda, which turns out to be more weapons to Ukraine, more needless wars in the Middle East, and endless blame chip for Israel. But the rhetoric around and, you know, more discussed on the internet, I do think, first of all, I think there's like less of an issue between necessarily like, are you on the right or the left? Like, even 10 years ago, I mean, I've been in the libertarian movement for, I think, closer to 20 years now. But, you know, there was a time when associating with somebody like Mads Blumenthal or Scott Horton would be seen as kind of like, ooh, can we trust Scott Horton? But now I think there's a lot of libertarians who, if you ask them about really important issues, and I don't want to attribute all these views to Mads necessarily, but somebody like our friend Misty Winston, I know is like, you know, what I think a lot of people would consider based on, you know, a lot of the cultural issues that matter too. Like, again, I'm not trying to put any positions in her mouth or anything like that, but if you follow her on X, I don't think as a libertarian you're going to see all that much content that's really offensive to you. And I think that this kind of movement towards, I don't know, populism, I think is maybe the general best catch-all to use, but I really don't know where, you know, where the anti-establishment, maybe that way too, has kind of lifted up everyone, where Dave Smith is getting absolutely massive, Scott Horton is getting huge, and then, you know, people like Dave DeCamp and myself, to a lesser extent, I mean, Dave has like 70,000 followers. He's on with Matt Gaetz all the time. And so I think it's impossible not to recognize that our voices are getting very loud. And I think that's an absolutely amazing thing. And it's on the cultural side too, right? For all the talk around the LP, I think that it shows that the election just happened and people are still really interested in what Scott Horton has to say and what Dave Smith has to say. They're still going to antiwar.com, the Libertarian Institute. Certainly my content over the past 6 months has gotten more attention than it's ever had, even during election seasons. And so, I'm really encouraged by it. I think it's a great thing. I think the Scott interview with Tucker was amazing. Tucker was, you know, interested through the whole time. You could tell he's asking little questions or adding details that not only help to keep the audience engaged, but give Scott like just that much more credibility as he's going through it. So, I thought the interview itself was amazing. And I would imagine that Scott's going to get more opportunities. Like, you know, he's on Candace Owens and Keith Knight, our boy Keith Knight was just on with Julian Michaels.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of great things happening for those of us in the libertarian movement. I think particularly like the Libertarian Institute anti-war crowd. And I think it's because people care more about this message and understand that, you know, America first, make America great again. If that's, you know, the message and the agenda that you support, well, you kind of got to be a Hortonian, right? You kind of got to have Scott Horton's views. And more people are recognizing that, and we're just growing and growing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very, very cool thing to see a lot of these people, like I said, get the recognition they deserve. Real quick, Eddie, CDB, thank you guys so much for dropping in today, and it's good to see everybody. Yeah, when I saw that Scott Horton interview drop, I'm like, oh, man, that is just so cool, because I'm sure you knew probably just as long as I did that like this was coming, and then, you know, the show with Daryl and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, dude, this is going to be huge for him. And of course it was. And, you know, the other point I wanted to touch on as well that you touched on was just the fact that like the left-right divide doesn't seem to be as apparent as it once was. I don't know what exactly it is, but like you said, someone like a Misty Winston, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté, some of our friends from the Revolutionary Blackout Network. I see a lot of the stuff they say on Twitter. I'm like, I don't really see that much I disagree with. Like when they say something about housing or economics, I'm like, yeah, that's dumb. But like, you know, we agree on what I feel is the most important issue. And that's really, we want an America that's free of empire. You know what I mean? Like, we don't want any more any more interventions. And we're kind of seeing this, a lot of the energy gets centered around like Trump was voted in to be the anti-war candidate and the peace president. I think you and I probably knew better. And that's not to say, you know, anything bad to people who voted for him or supported him, but it's just kind of like it was obvious to us because we already knew the record and his rhetoric and what was going to happen from there. But, you know, it's good to see that, like, a lot of people are like, oh, no, like, what's going on now is not what we want, and we need to have something else.
Yeah. Well, and I also think there's another kind of interesting dynamic where the corporations have essentially become the government at this point.
Right.
Right? The world's richest man, Elon Musk, built his empire on electric vehicle subsidies and Pentagon contracts. That's why he's the world's richest man. And everybody knows that a lot of other the top industries either have way too much influence on government or government has way too much influence on them. Right. Like if you look at the military industrial complex, like this isn't capitalism. This isn't what libertarians support. And so there's a lot of industry that we could kind of all hate on together. I mean, there may be some things, but I think in general, libertarians like recognize the amount of corruption that goes on and that we really don't have in any way a capitalist system. And so we're not necessarily having to defend that. Now, once you get into where to go from there, like how do you resolve this problem, then, you know, yeah, Scott Horton and Mads Blumenthal have a lot of differences, but that's almost a step down the road in first just letting people know that, hey, we have a massive problem here. And I also think that there's probably a lot of recognition from the left wingers, the problem with kind of government control. A lot of these people were against a lot of the culture war, a lot of the woke stuff, but also a lot of the COVID mandates and crackdowns. I think Mads was one of the first person I heard other than myself to go, you know, the lockdowns, like don't pretend that these are for the everyman. The everyman doesn't have a check. Right. Like $800 is nothing. $2,000 is nothing. Right. And so locking people down isn't going to hurt Chris Cuomo and the elites of this country. It is going to hurt the people who can no longer go to work and no longer have jobs. And, you know, it really did, I think, expose a sense of where there were two classes during COVID, like the people running around, picking up food, dropping it off. And then, you know, the people in whatever class it is that got to work remotely from home and or just had enough money built up. And so there's, I think, been a lot of recognition that, like, the government truly is our enemy. And there is, a true need for an anti-establishment direction. Now, I think the big thing is what direction do we go in? Right. Because, you know, one direction leads, I'm afraid, to more government control. You know, if you put the government in control of more business, where I think the libertarian direction, just like simply shrinking the size and the scope of government as much as we possibly can, has to be the right direction at this point. Simply like kind of thinking that we're going to have a less corrupt government is not going to work. Now, that being said, I do wonder if, say, you know, you do elect some communists like this guy in New York City or something.
Yeah.
Like, maybe if he's just 10% less corrupt, it's actually going to go a little bit better. And so I think there could almost be some false indications that, like, communism works because the current capitalist communist like combined system where there's just so much corporate subsidies where they steal so much from us every single day to continue to like transfer the wealth upwards that with that there's going to be a real desire to move to the left. And if left wingers get elected and they just cut into that, like they just cut down on the corruption, it's not necessarily that their policies are better than our policies, but their policies are better than the status quo, then I'm worried that this country can move in a really, you know, left wing direction really quickly.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that as well, because one thing that I've always thought about is, like, imagine being someone yours or my age, which I think you're 34, 35, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, imagine being right around our age, right? So you grew up through the early 2000s and maybe even the 90s a little bit, and you saw your parents were able to afford a car and the internet, and, like, life really changed. And, you know, from, like, the 90s to the early 2000s, like, we're talking going from nobody having cell phones to everybody having a 4K camera inside their pocket now, right, within the span of, like, 20 years. And then like now people our age are starting to have kids and families. And then now like we realize like, oh, our kids, if the, you know, economy keeps going the way that it's going, they may not own a house. Like they may rent for the rest of their lives. They're going to live with us as an extended adults for, you know, an indefinite amount of time because the economy is so bad. Like I'm sure you probably look at people 10 years younger than you. At least I know I do this. And I'm like, oh, you might not own a house. You're going to struggle to have a car payment, go to school, do all this stuff that just 30 years ago, you'd struggle, but it was possible. Now it's like, this is impossible to juggle all of these things. And people are just like, oh, no, I don't want a family. So from that perspective, I get it why people are like, yeah, socialism must be great. Because if this is capitalism, which is what they're told it is, even though you and I would agree it's not, how could you not just be like, yeah, give me socialism. Because like what's going on right now, it's not feasible for what I want.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I'm just trying to think like the number of friends that I have from high school or college that, you know, own a house and are married and have a kid is,
yeah,
you know, I could count like on one hand. And that's not just because I'm an introvert. That's because, you know, a lot of these guys either live at home with their parents or they're just kind of perpetually single. They live in an apartment or in a house with some other guys, but, you know, they don't own a house. They're not planning to buy a house. You know, it's just, It seems so far out of their reach that they're not even trying. And that is, yeah, huge problems that we have in this country, including the fact that so many of us go to college and waste so much money on degrees that are never really meaningful. And it's, you know, another burden that makes home ownership just that much more inconceivable, which, of course, you know, that means like having a kid or something like that seems inconceivable as well.
Yeah, so, well, I guess we should probably pivot over to the some of the foreign policy topics that you're an expert in. Not that I don't want to talk to you about this kind of stuff, but this also does kind of go into a lot of this other stuff too. But like a lot of people, like I said earlier, voted for Trump as a peace candidate, and now he performed a drone strike on Iran at a couple different nuclear facilities. And it's been dubbed the 12-day war. I have so many people who are super pro-MAGA saying, oh my God, he ended this war so decisively, so quickly. This never would have happened if he didn't perform these strikes on Iran. And my stance on this the entire time has been, I don't think this is over yet. Like, it sounds good, but what I've noticed as a pattern with the Trump administration is that they'll say, we got a ceasefire. And then either one party doesn't agree to it or, you know, typically this around Israel and Israel agrees to it. The other party may agree to it, but then 10 times out of 10, Israel breaks the ceasefire and then things are back on. So I guess let's kind of walk through what all happened with the Iran-Israel conflict, the 12-day war. Do you think it's over? Where do you think it's going? Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's over. I think the problem that we have right now is Trump is completely unpredictable and possibly mentally incompetent. And, you know, Robbie Bernstein would probably tell me that nobody wants to hear that storyline. And I think that's really the problem that's going on, is we just sat through a President Biden who for 4 years were told sharp as attack. And it turns out, as everybody could see, he's completely mentally incapacitated. Now, you know, for people who have seen people get dementia, there's kind of two different kinds. There's like the depressed dementia, which Biden seemed to have. You know, sometimes you get angry, but often you're just kind of muttering to yourself and incoherent. And then you have like the overjoyous, jubilant dementia. And I think that's kind of where Trump is, where he's, you know, he's very spry. He seems to be enjoying, I mean, he's like kind of like, you know, being firm and things, but I think he's enjoying being president this time around, probably more even than he did his first time. He's, you know, absolutely confident and certain in every action that he's taken, even though he's constantly flip-flopping and seems to have no idea what the hell he's doing. On my show today, my producer put together this great clip for me where, you know, on the first day, Trump is saying on July 7th, Trump says we're going to send more weapons to Ukraine. And then on July 8th, a reporter asked Trump about, well, the Pentagon last week said you were pausing some arms shipments to Ukraine. So are you reversing that? And he's saying, I didn't do that. And he asked the reporter, who gave that order? I don't know who gave that order. And then the next day, somebody asked him, do you know who gave the order? And he says, no, I still don't know. And I don't even care. But if that order was given, I would know who gave the order. And since I didn't give the order wasn't given. Mm-hmm. And it was just like really confusing. And Kyle, I'm sure that if it was Joe Biden who said that, everybody would be like, look at this absolutely demented clown in front of us. Like, they are parading this guy in front of us as if he knows what he's doing. But honestly, I think even the liberals are so tired of talking about demented presidents. And look, I guess saying Trump's demented is probably too far. You know, he's in like moderate cognitive decline due to advanced age.
He's old.
He's very old. And, you know, has, I'm sure, had a good amount of fun in his life. And, you know, now appears to be like a very old man who doesn't remember things from one day to the next. And so anyways, the reason I'm getting around to all of this and trying to say why it's so hard to say is this only going to be a 12-day war is I think at some point Netanyahu is going to be able to kind of bully Trump into going along with another strike on Iran. Right. Where even if Trump's instincts are not to strike Iran again, even if it's something he really doesn't want to do and will resist on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, just know that John Ratcliffe, our CIA director, is going against the U.S. intelligence community and giving Trump Mossad assessments on Iran's nuclear program. They're obviously false. You know, you have the U.S. intelligence community saying that Iran has not decided to build a nuclear weapon, right? And then you have Ratcliffe telling Donald Trump, and apparently Trump believed it, that they were 15 days away from building a nuclear weapon. And it's absolutely absurd and it's absolutely stupid, but he has just absolutely tons of influence. Ron Dermer, who is an American, James Carden described him on my show as a traitor, is now a member of the Israeli Knesset, and one of Benjamin Netanyahu's closest allies. He's in the White House all the time, they say, right? And so he's somebody who is the Israeli government, but he's an American. And so you know that appeals to Donald Trump, and that he is just telling Donald Trump every day what a great man he is and what a great president he is and what a strong leader he is and how everybody in Israel just loves Donald Trump so much and it's so great what he's doing for the Holy Land. And he's, you know, probably got all this like kind of divine-ish rhetoric like we've heard from Mike Huckabee. And he's fluffing Trump up and he's saying, but these Iranians, you know, they're real bad. We got to do something about them. And my guess is that this is eventually going to break Trump's will to be America first. And I think a part of it is because he just doesn't have the like mental fortitude at his age to resist so much pressure.
Yeah. So one thing that I think kind of goes off of what you just said there is this kind of seems to be a theme with all the negotiations, is that they're like, as I put it, like limp wristed. Like, it sounds good. They always make it seem like they're making all this progress. But then like if things get even like the slightest bit of pushback, and this was also a theme throughout his first presidency, that like as soon as things got difficult, nope. All right, whatever. If Netanyahu says we got to bomb Iran, I'll be like, I don't think we should do that. But then as soon as Netanyahu says, no, we really have to do it, he's like, all right, man, whatever, let's just do it. This just seems to be such a common theme with the Trump administration, is that, like, I'm glad that, like, at least they're negotiating with, like, Russia, and that there were some negotiated ceasefires that both parties had agreed to in Israel. But though it just seems like as soon as Israel does what the U.S. doesn't want it to do, which is almost every single time, they're just like, all right, well, yeah, moving on. We'll just keep going with whatever you want.
Yeah. I can't decide. There, I think, two things that kind of cause this, and I'm not sure which one it is. But you're right. If you look at Trump's first administration, I always say if you want to know about Trump's first second administration, look at his first. When he talks about getting a nuclear deal done with Iran, was he able to get a nuclear deal done with North Korea? No. He wasn't. You know, there was never a deal done. Sure, the North Korea portfolio probably wasn't a better place at the end of the Trump administration versus the start of the Trump administration. But still, you know, he was never able to ink that deal, which meant that we were, you know, on the path to, you know, escalation on the Korean Peninsula and things like that. Anyways, in that we saw under the Biden presidency. And now I think we see it with Iran and with Russia. And so I think more likely the problem is attention span, that international deals take months, if not years, to build. Yeah. Right. They start with low level State Department officials getting together and the Americans, you know, giving the Russians a stack of paper that explains the American position and the Russians giving the American a stack of paper back. And the Americans go to their superiors and they, you know, write little memos and briefs and, you know, all this takes weeks to do. And then mid-level officials get together and they actually, you know, say, oh, well, you know, these three things, these sound reasonable. We'll include them in our deal. But, you know, these 10 things, we absolutely can't have that. And then you have high level negotiations where a similar refinement happens. And so, you know, it takes, again, months, if not years, to actually get a deal done. Mm-hmm. And it takes allowing these low level negotiations not only to happen, but Trump does have to be actively involved on the American side. He has to control the press around it. He can't let a giant, like, this is what happens with Iran, where the senators and the American media and Israeli officials, as soon as the Trump administration was talking with the Iranians about letting them enrich uranium to the same level that the 2015 Obama deal did, they had an absolute panic attack and lost their minds. And they're, oh, how could Trump do this? He's giving away everything to the Iranians. He's such a bad negotiator. And so Trump bows to the political pressure. And so I think it's like kind of that dynamic that basically doesn't allow a deal.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
To get done under the Trump administration. Now, if that's the case, I think the good news is if he could ever sit down in a room with Vladimir Putin or the Ayatollah or something like that, maybe they could actually hammer out a deal. Just if it doesn't take a lot of time, if there's not a lot of back and forth. I guess if, you know, the North Koreans were to come to me and they were to ask how they would, I would go about trying to make a deal with Trump, I would say, you know, don't mess around with all these State Department lower level talks, you know, get a meeting set up. Trump and Kim get in a room together and they're going to work out a deal in the room together. They'll sign it before anybody gets any commentary and then we'll find out what it is after. I mean, I really think like that's the only way you would be able to get a deal done under Trump, because he always caves to the political pressure. And I think it's an attention span issue that he really doesn't care about these issues that much. And he doesn't want to talk about them day after day after day. The other issue, and this one, I don't know, I'm more pessimistic, I guess, if this is the case, that Trump's negotiating style in real estate and everything has always been, you get every last dime that you can. And so if that means that, you know, after the hotel is done and you're supposed to pay the plumbers, you stiff them. You have them take you to court and then you settle for less than you were going to pay them in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right. This is, I think, how Trump does business. And it doesn't work on the international stage. No. And it certainly, you know, OK, maybe it works with Colombia. Maybe it works with Venezuela. It doesn't work with North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, these major geopolitical powers in the world who have large economies. They could resist and stand up to U.S. sanctions. And so whenever he tries to make a deal with the Iranians, he'll go in and he'll propose a perfectly reasonable deal. Everybody is happy. They're all like shaking hands and thinking they got a good deal. And then when they go to sign it, Trump puts another deal down on the table. And this one demands complete capitulation. Now, I think he's probably willing to negotiate from there still. However, in geopolitics, this is just seen as really insulting. People right. don't stand for it. They leave, they walk away. And on top of that, if a country has come to what they see as a reasonable deal, mm-hmm. and then you demand more, it's not the same thing as a New York real estate deal. It just, it isn't. And so I worry that that's actually the case, which means I don't think Trump will ever be able to get a deal done with anyone because of the way he kind of conducts these like backhanded negotiations.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mention that specifically, because when you look at the way that he talks, you know, he called for evacuating Tehran. And then, oh, we need regime change. And he's all over the place. He drone strikes him and then says, oh, well, I want a deal. And like you said, we're like, you're talking about countries, people that don't share a culture. I mean, these people are completely different than you. You kind of have to be willing to meet them where they're at and then work with them. Like this whole arbitrary 60-day deal, why would you do that? Because one thing I wrote down while you were talking there is just like with the whole JCPOA, like you mentioned, these deals take time. Like the JCPOA, I think, took like over 2 years to work that out. So like, why would you expect that you're going to come to a deal in 60 days? And on top of that, you know, the U.S. isn't what it was back in 2016 during his first term. I mean, we had 4 years of Joe Biden that really ruined a lot of relations with no negotiations. You know, the Joe Biden policy was no negotiations, no matter what, escalation everywhere, and just hope for the best. At least Trump's trying to do negotiations, but, you know, I don't think he understands that just like the world's in a different place. The U.S. doesn't have the same standing that it once did. China and Russia are now more powerful than they used to be. So you kind of have to respect their sovereignty and, you know, once again, meet them where they're at and, you know, respect that, like, hey, if we come to a deal, we can't get everything that we want, because now Iran can go, you know, they've been getting, you know, military armaments from China at this point, and probably some from Russia as well. It's not like they're completely interdependent on one another, but there is a relationship here where now if the U.S. is going to screw Iran, Iran doesn't have to sit there and take it anymore.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair point, and maybe something that people don't really appreciate how much damage the Biden administration did right. to the U.S. world order with their economic war against Russia, where I was talking to Ben Ablow about this today. One of the things that's so interesting here is how the narrative actually got ahead of the policy, and that they had scared the American people so much about Putin and Russia that they were demanding, the people were demanding, do more, do more, do more. And so they actually put more sanctions on Russia than they were comfortable with. They knew it would hurt their economies quite a bit, but they were sanctioning Russia because you know, they had to do something. They can't bomb Moscow. They can't take it that far. And so, you know, to do something, what they decided to do was more and more sanctions. Well, you know, this really, I think, accelerated the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS, and more countries are, I think, assessing two things. One, the BRICS coalition has what they need. Right. So if they step out of the American-led world order, it's not as if their people are not going to be able to buy cars right. or they're not going to be able to import steel or oil or nuclear fuel. Like, all these things can be bought from different countries in BRICS. And the second thing is that China and Russia really don't care about your internal politics all that much. And while I'm sure like China offers some abusive Belt and Road loans in the same way the U.S. does with the International Monetary Fund, I don't think anybody could look at the situation on the globe right now and think that the Americans are a better business partner than the Chinese are. It's the case that the Americans, especially under Donald Trump, right? I mean, look at what he's trying to do, where if a country doesn't do what he wants, he just threatens economic nuclear bombs on them, that we're going to increase tariffs by 50 or 100%. And of course, the U.S. being such a large economy, that's a huge deal to a lot of countries. It makes a big difference to a lot of countries. And Trump, I mean, has threatened this over some relatively trivial things, like countries not wanting to take back migrants and things like this. And so if you have to choose to be within the Western economic world order with an erratic president who might throw you out of it at any time, or to be within Brits, which just wants more countries to trade with. I mean, I'm sure Brits looks increasingly appealing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I really kind of propose that, like, this idea that the tariffs and the escalating trade war are really going to test out how strong BRICS is. Because if you're denying access to dollars to all these markets, then I think this is really going to test out if China, India, and all these other countries, although India is kind of on the way out with BRICS, if all these countries can sustain themselves without access to dollars. And I think the answer is going to be probably yes at this point, because once again, we just don't live in the same world anymore where, like, there still is dollar hegemony, but, like, these countries, I don't think any, you know, need it necessarily anymore. And real quick, don't click on this link, everybody, but this is a link to Kali and Salone's show with Benjamin Ablo. It was absolutely fantastic. So just whenever you're done here, make sure you go over there and check that out. But yeah, I think that, the world's in a different place now, and I think Trump overestimates the U.S.'s role in that. And, you know, I wish the U.S. was still the hegemon in a more positive aspect, where it's like, yeah, well, we help negotiate peace, and we help negotiate trade, instead of we help bomb the shit out of countries that we don't like and overthrow the ones that we don't either. But that's not the world we live in. Oh, you're muted.
Or that our country was still such an economic powerhouse, right? That it kind of didn't matter that other countries would just want to do business with us because we were producing so many great and awesome things. But, you know, while I don't want to completely dismiss it and sound like a doomer and be like, oh, America has passed its prime, because there is still some great production and some great things that do happen in this country. At the same time, that's obviously been hollowed out in a lot of ways, mostly by the corruption and political rot in this country.
Yeah, I agree. GM Kyle X too. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. So one other thing I wanted to talk about was the Ukraine-Russia war. And I know we touched on it a little bit. It's kind of been all over the place now. I'm sure you probably had the same feeling that I did when Trump kept saying he would end it in 24 hours and that this would have never happened under his watch. I'm like, I'm sorry, guys. He's full of shit. If you paid attention, like you just said earlier, if you pay attention to his first administration, then you could kind of get a loose outline of how the second administration was going to go, because he's still going to be surrounded by the same people. You're still dealing with the same president. So it was kind of obvious to me that, you know, the tensions with Russia were going to continue to increase. So everybody was hopeful he was going to end the war in Ukraine, but now it seems like he's sending more weapons in. And from our mutual friend, Dave DeCamp, I want to make sure let me share this real quick. According to Reuters, according to Reuters, Trump is expected to soon approve a new military aid package for Ukraine worth $300 million using the presidential drawdown authority, which allows him to send weapons directly from U.S. stockpiles. Yeah, man, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, well, so this is, I guess, kind of so far what I thought was going to happen. Sure. That the Biden administration had sent Ukraine enough weapons that Ukraine could continue to fight until the summer. And then sometime between the summer and the fall, a decision would have to be made. Is Trump going to start sending Ukraine weapons? And if he goes down that road, then, you know, he's basically making this war his. And if he doesn't send Ukraine weapons, well, then Zelensky and the Ukrainians have some tough choices to make. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess there's a couple of factors here. I think the Trump administration has between like $2.5 and $4 billion in congressionally approved military aid left that they could send to Ukraine. And so, you know, this could pay for probably a few hundred thousand artillery shells. I heard the Wall Street Journal reported that they were going to send a new Patriot battery. I think those are like $1.5 billion. Patriot missiles, they were sending at least 10. Those are $4 million each. And so you could see how, you know, even like $4 billion wouldn't go very far if the U.S. government wants to continue to support this war under Trump. Mm-hmm. And so my guess would be if Trump wants to continue to support this war, he would have through October, late fall, to get Congress to pass another massive military spending package for Ukraine. Or maybe he just doesn't go to Congress and keeps sending the weapons anyways. While people might think that, oh, we have a constitution and Congress declares war, Congress sets the budget. I mean, the Biden administration scammed this thing the whole time. This has got to be one of the biggest frauds in American history that nobody ever talked about, where the Congress approved, like, I forget what the number was, but say $50 billion in arms to send to Ukraine. And this was through the Presidential Drawdown Authority, which allows the arms to be sent directly from the U.S. stockpile to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so when Congress approves, say, $5 or $10 or $50 billion for that fund, what they're doing is they're, so we send a Humvee over there, Kyle, but now we have to build a new one. I'm sure you know that the new Humvee costs more than the one that they sent over, right? It's a used car, so it's not worth what it was when it drove off the lot. Now, who knows what the actual value of a used Humvee is? It's not like a F-150 where there's transactions going on all the time and it's very easy to price. But, you know, the cost that Congress appropriates is the cost to buy a new one and replace it, which is how this is supposed to work, because of course the U.S. government needs the weapons in its stockpiles. And so if you're sending a Humvee to Ukraine, then you have to buy a new one, and that's the money that Congress is appropriating. Well, I think it was the summer of 2023 that the Biden administration decided that, well, we're out of money to send to Ukraine, but you know what? We actually have been valuating this wrong. Congress isn't approving money for us to buy new weapons. They're approving us, giving us money to send weapons to Ukraine. So actually the value is the value of the weapons that we sent to Ukraine. And so they just gave themselves an additional $7 billion worth of arms to send to Ukraine. It was absolutely insane. I couldn't believe it, but they just did it. They got away with it. And nobody ever complained about it. It's just absolutely wild that something like that could happen in the United States of America. I mean, the level of corruption and scam to just steal $7 billion. And that's why right now, Kyle, the Trump administration, the Pentagon is saying that we have only 25% of the Patriot missiles that we need to execute our battle plans. I mean, that should be like huge red flags to Americans, that we've hollowed out our own defense base in order to conduct an accounting scam so we could send more arms to Ukraine. But that's exactly what happened under the Trump-Biden administration. And now Trump is going to continue along with it. And I guess my overall point here is that Trump probably doesn't have to go to Congress to get money to fund this war, although I think he will, which, look, I would like to say, won't pass, that enough Democrats will be against it because it's Trump, and enough Republicans will be opposed to it because they actually philosophically oppose this position. But like we've seen with the Big Beautiful Bill and other things, it doesn't really tend to go that way. Now, I guess on maybe the piece of good news here is that logistically, who knows how much longer we could carry out this war. Of course, it would be absolutely horrible if, you know, my prediction from early in the war became true, which is that we fight the Russians until the last Ukrainian. And, you know, obviously not the very last Ukrainian. It's not just going to be Zelensky standing in Kiev with a gun. But
we can only hope.
But that the Ukrainian military is reduced to a level so low that it effectively collapses, and that the Russian military just rolls through and then dictates terms to Zelensky at the barrel of a gun. Now, I think the other possibility, and hopefully it's this, I think this is the best hope we have, is that the Pentagon goes to Donald Trump and they say, sir, the Biden administration, they fucked us, and they fucked good. There are no artillery shells. There are no Patriot missiles. If China attacks Taiwan tomorrow, we can do nothing. We're sorry, but we have to decide between Ukraine and Taiwan. And guess what? Taiwan makes the semiconductors. We think China's worse than Russia. Like there's some hope to get along with the Russians. And so please, Mr. President, tell Zelensky he's got 3 months and it's over. And maybe that 3 month runway is too much and Trump will just have to cut him off. I think the good news is that Trump did really just cut off the Ukrainians. If the Europeans were smart, they could go to Zelensky and say, listen, we could cover your ass for 3 months and we could let you hammer out a deal with the Russians. And that way you don't have to negotiate at the barrel of a gun. And we can help you out and get some concessions from Vladimir Putin in that realm. But listen, buddy, like it's the end of the line. You know, we've converted our air-to-air missiles into missile interceptors and given those to you. You know, we've converted our bombs and slapped rocket engines on them so you could use them as bombs even though you don't have fighter jets. The stockpiles are empty. We can't do it. Logistically, it's impossible. It may be nice to think that we meant whatever it takes for as long as it takes, but now there's simply nothing left. And so, reality sets in and Zelensky cuts the deal. I think that's the best exit for the Ukrainian people at this point.
Yeah, man, I really hope for that. One person I heard you mention on your show, I can't remember who you were talking to. It was your guest, I think, yesterday morning. But you guys were talking about Elbridge Colby. Now, this is somebody that I've tried to keep a little bit more of an active eye on. I remember reading an article couple weeks ago, and a quote from the article was something akin to, and I'll paraphrase it to the best of my ability, was, "We can't get Elbridge Colby to focus on Iran because he's so focused on China." Which on one hand, it's like, okay, well, we know the U.S. really wants, basically what the U.S. is, you know, the U.S. military's goal is, we want to bleed Russia dry, we want to bleed Iran dry, and we really want to bleed China dry by using their basic, you know, our proxies, if you will, as in, yeah. Taiwan will be our proxy, Israel will be our proxy, and Ukraine is our proxy. But it seems like we're so bogged down in Ukraine. Trump hasn't been able to do anything right in Ukraine. You know, the Iran stuff seems to be a little bit calmed down right now. And, you know, we'll see kind of how that goes. Like you and I said, I think that's going to flare back up. What do you think about Elbridge Colby, and do you think he's kind of a savior in the situation, or do you think he's just kind of like a temporary or, you know, a long-term enemy? What's your thoughts?
Yeah. So, I mean, my initial thoughts are, I wish we lived in a world where, you know, we were the like restrainers, the non-interventionist, and then Elbridge Colby and John Mearsheimer were the hawks. Right, like that should be the reasonable political spectrum in the United States of America. Like, we could take on, do we want to go and prepare for war with this superpower or not? Not global domination, or you're a pussy, which is essentially the position of most people in the establishment right now, right? Like, it's, you know, you have to be willing to fight Russia, Iran, North Korea, China, Venezuela, Cuba, well, formerly Syria, I guess. Now we're okay with Syria now that there's jihadists there. Yemen, Ansar Allah, right? Like, you have to be willing to go to war with any of these countries as a drop of a hat, or you're considered a dove in this country. When in reality, that's just a completely stupid, ridiculous, counterproductive policy that's not sustainable in any way whatsoever, right? It's the policy of somebody who's neurotic, right? Who has like serious personality issues and not personality, like mental health issues, and is like, you know, on the verge of schizophrenia, right? Like, you cannot be so paranoid that you think that everybody else can't have the ability to defend themselves from you, or else they could be plotting to get you. Right. Like, but that's the policy of the United States and Israel. Netanyahu was talking about this in the White House just a couple days ago. He said, sure, there could be a Palestinian state, but we get to maintain absolute security over them, which means they never get to have a military. Right. That's the way the United States wants to treat the rest of the world, where you could do what you want so long as you do what we want first. And we don't want to allow a situation to arise where if somebody says no, that they could actually resist us, right? Like, we get to demand everybody's capitulation at all times. And that's the establishment foreign policy in this country. That's what the people around the president, the people around the former president, the people around Obama, the people around Bush, they all thoroughly believe this, that Russia gets no say if their neighboring countries are joining the North Atlantic Alliance, that China gets no say on what happens in Taiwan or the South China Sea, that Iran has no say in Iraq or Syria or Lebanon, and yet the U.S. gets to dictate what happens everywhere in the world, including Tehran and Moscow and Beijing. That is explicitly our policy at this point. And so, you know, I want to live in a world where I could hate Elbridge Colby and think he is just the worst person in the White House. And how dare he fearmonger our country into a war, into an unnecessary war with China. But given the current situation where we're fighting essentially two wars right now, one in the Middle East and one in Ukraine, well, the guy who's saying, well, let's stop those wars so we could focus for a potential future war in China sounds like the only reasonable person in the room.
Man, that is a bitter pill to swallow. But you're unfortunately not wrong. So I guess we should probably wrap up the last few minutes with kind of what gives us hope about this whole situation. So I think part of your optimism around Elbridge Colby, if I could call it that roughly, surrounds some of the individuals that are good friends of yours that also have published at antiwar.com, if I recall correctly. Why don't you tell the audience about who those individuals are? I know they were working with the Trump administration. I think one of them isn't anymore, but tell me about some of that.
I'm not 100% sure who you're talking about.
Daniel Davis, right? And then there was another person who was a staffer.
I'm not sure if Daniel Davis has published articles at antiwar.com.
Okay, I apologize. Yeah.
He was somebody who was almost Tulsi Gabbard's assistant, right? Like, he was almost in the Trump administration. But certainly is somebody who we like a lot at antiwar.com. He's frequently on the Scott Horton show. Mm-hmm. If I could ever get him to come on the Kyle Anzalone show, I consider that to be a huge honor. There's a few other people. Dan Cladwell was in the government. He's somebody whose articles we have run in the past at antiwar.com.
Okay. Yeah.
I believe there's somebody else who's associated with Defense Priorities, which is a pretty solid think tank. They do some pretty good work. They're not, again, you know, I would love it if it was me debating with the guys from Defense Priorities on what America's foreign policy should be, because at least that would be a reasonable foreign policy to argue. Like, you know, do we need to prepare for war with China or something like that? Or, you know, do we just need to bring all of our troops home from everywhere? Like, that should be the discussion. It's just not. And so, yeah, I think most of these people have been removed. I believe Joe Kent is now Tulsi Gabbard's deputy, which is interesting. I know he's been better on some issues, but not really. So I guess I don't see a whole lot of optimism in the White House on the philosophic side of things. You do just wonder if there's enough real bureaucrats in the United States that are capable of going to the president and saying, like, sir, we just can't do this, or sir, this just isn't true. Like, you know, when the Cheney and Rumsfeld were agitating and trying to get Bush to go to war with Iran, it was the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Security Establishment that came out with its intelligence assessment that said Iran wasn't building a nuclear weapon, and essentially, you know, took away all the momentum and steam that the Hawks had for going to war. Like, do those people still exist within the Trump administration? It certainly seems like if they did, that they would have stopped the war with Iran, which they were completely unable to do. And while Tulsi didn't completely capitulate, she at least tried to confuse the situation enough and make it look like she capitulated with the tweet she put out saying that the media was misquoting her when she said Iran wasn't building a nuclear weapon. And so I don't see a lot of hope for this, like, you know, on the philosophical side of the Trump administration, but maybe, like, you know, just logistically it'll become impossible to operate this empire at some point. And look, you know, Trump may be the perfect guy to blow the empire's last load. It just, you know, depends on what comes next. Is it somebody who's a reasonable person who would want to take the United States in the right direction? Or, it, you know, it could very well be like AOC or Bernie Sanders type.
Ugh, God.
I know.
Man. Very, very grim to consider. I mean, I guess at least they tacitly say some good things about Israel, but I don't know, man. It just seems like every single time you hear somebody on the right track, like Tulsi Gabbard saying Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, all of a sudden she flips on a dime. And I mean, that was pretty upsetting because, like, you look at her history rhetoric, and I'm just saying her rhetoric, not her voting record, just her rhetoric, is that, oh, I'm anti-war, but they'll just... It seems like every single time Tulsi Gabbard had a chance to move up her career at the sake of just forsaking everything that made her great, or at least great in the eyes of the people, she just chooses her career 10 times out of 10.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I guess we all still owe her a huge debt of gratitude to ending Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. there is always that, like, you got to always give Tulsi credit for that. But yeah, I mean, I generally speaking, I do agree with you that she's a careerist, and as maybe as good of instincts as she had, as maybe philosophically she was in a good place at one point, she's obviously now just willing to do what it takes to get along in Washington.
Yeah, oh man. So I guess to round it all up, Ron Paul had once said the troops are coming home, whether it's I think it's the U.S.'s decision or not. I guess, do you think that's kind of our one hope of our one note of optimism there?
Yeah, exactly. I hope it's at least enough of the U.S.'s decision that our troops are coming home alive and not fleeing. You know, there are certainly better ways to unwind the empire than others, but overall, the empire just needs to end in sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I completely agree. We got families to build and other cool stuff to do. I got all these guitars and, like, a legacy to leave behind. Kyle, I know you do lots of great stuff. So we got 1,700 people watching live. This awesome. Is pretty awesome. I'm stoked that everybody was able to retweet it, support, and all that good stuff. So I guess we'll kind of wrap up here. Kyle, why don't you let everybody know one more time where they can find you, support you, and do all that good stuff.
All right, best place to go is my Twitter handle, at KyleLanzalone_. After that, subscribe to the Kyle Anzalone Show on YouTube. I also host Conflicts of Interest, which is hosted at the Libertarian Institute, where I'm the news editor. I do the daily debrief, the new email blast that we put out, along with writing some news stories for that website. Also write some news over at judgenap.com, and I'm the opinion editor at antiwar.com.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'm Pure Hunter right at the end here. Defend the Guard legislation is key. Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely.
Got their support. Diego Rivera, I think his name is. And if there's legislation up in your locale, definitely support that stuff. So anyways, everybody, thank you so much for watching. And this Sunday, I'm going to have my friend Dickie on to talk about the Back to the Beginning Black Sabbath concert. So be sure to check out that. That's going to be the return of our Sunday coffee show. And Kyle, if you got anything else, we'll call our show there.
I'm good. Thanks, Kyle.
All right. Thank you. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. And until next time, take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.